Wednesday, September 6th, reach into the unknown with Dr. Strange.
Do you believe in evil?
You're telling me you're a sorcerer.
Don't defy me, Stephen, or I'll take my pleasure from you in another way.
John Mills is the power of good. Jessica Walter is the power of evil, and mankind's fate hangs in the balance. Peter Hooton stars as the man in the middle, Dr. Strange. Will the forces of evil conquer the forces of good on Earth? Dr. Strange, a special two-hour presentation, Wednesday, September 6th at 8, 7 Central and Mountain.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. You're listening to a brand new episode of Tales from the Couch Zone. And as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Dazza. Dazza, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Excellent. Now, if that intro was enough of an indicator, Dazza, we have you on. And for people that don't know, you were lucky, you were privy enough to watch Doctor Strange before the rest of us on the other side of the pond. I'm curious, what did you think?
I really enjoyed it. You know, this was one that it wasn't until the last week or so that I really sort of started to look forward to, you know, as a Marvel movie. Because just, I mean, the thing is, going back, I never really read the Doctor Strange solo comic regularly. I think it's basically, I just couldn't get a hold of it, even when I was buying like loads and loads of different Marvel stuff. That one I just never got a hold of. And so I'm not really that up on all the... I have a sort of, I know a bit about the characters, I know the general feeling, but I'm not really into the mythos and everything that's driving it, stuff. But so I went in this really not having much of a you know, any preconceptions or anything like that, and just as a film, I really, really enjoyed it. It did a really good job of introducing the whole concept of magic into the Marvel Universe and doing something different, which is something I was a bit sort of like dubious about, whether they could actually do service to the whole idea of doing magic, but at the same time make it accessible for people so they would basically be able to understand and not get too overridden by it. But that is something that they did massively well. I have to say as well, one of the things that I think I mentioned this when we talked about the trailers that I was disappointed with is the special effects and the magic and everything look to be very much like Inception, mm-hmm. You know, with the sort of changing buildings and stuff like that. And I mentioned how I was like really disappointed if that's the way they were going, because I wanted like a really big psychedelic scenes and everything and lots of colour and lots of like weird stuff, you know, from the comic. I've got to say, all that is in there. if you're wanting really, really trippy Pink Floyd style imagery and just sort of really wacky stuff that makes you feel like you've just dropped a load of acid, you're going to get that. It's not, and it's great because they saved it for the film. We didn't spoil it in the trailers or anything like that. But there are some scenes that just sort of just blow your mind. In many ways, this is a film, it's unlike anything I've seen in a Marvel film before. Even stuff like Guardians of the Galaxy, which had like a space theme and everything, the film looks so incredible. I mean, the opening scene, and this is, we should have said this before we started, but basically this is a non-spoiler review. I realise I'm not a lot of people are going to get to see it for another week. Mm-hmm. But the opening scene was just absolutely fantastic. You know, there was a sort of battle scene that just sort of, you know, really set, you know, of what you were seeing, that you're going to see something special. And this is one of those things that, you know, we talk about CGI and stuff. The CGI was done really, really well and creatively. And when it's done creatively like that, you know, I've no problem with it. It's when it's sort of done in a way that basically makes it just look like a sort of, you know, a massive cartoon. But here it just sort of used the whole concept of CGI really great. I have to say as well, a lot of the special effects that you saw in the trailers, the finished product is a lot better. The stuff when he went out did the outer body experience and stuff, that looks so much better on screen. The stuff with the sort of the mirrors and the glass, basically all the special effects were just wonderfully done. And they do use some of that real imagination, with the film. It was just, you know, to look at it was beautiful. This is a film that I'm sort of, although it's not a film I would go to see again, just generally, I am thinking of going to see it again, but this time seeing it in 3D.
Ooh, nice.
And I'm not a fan of 3D. I find it quite distracting, But certain films, I will sort of, you know, if I think it warrants it, I will like to see in 3D. And this is one where there's certain scenes that I just want to see what it looks like in 3D, you know, because it just looks sort of made for that. But the whole film, you know, like I say, the storyline is somewhat, it reminded me a lot of the first Iron Man movie, in that a lot of the story is pretty much Doctor Strange's character arc. Mm-hmm. And basically him sort of like, you know, his development and the sort of, you know, the conflict with the sort of, you know, the battles against evils. I won't say it's tacked on because it's always there, but it doesn't come into play till quite late in the movie. You know, but even so, you know, but it was the Doctor Strange thing that you were here to see. And, you know, the story, it was good. And I have to say, it had a really original resolution to the movies. It wasn't just a case of what the sort of shoot here to win type thing that you sort of get with a lot of the superhero movies. So you know, generally speaking, you know, I love the whole film. Acting wise, I think this is one of the I mean, you just have to look at the cast. And acting wise, this was like, you know, one of the top notch. And I think you needed this because there's frankly a lot of nonsense in this film. You know, if you were sort of, you needed somebody like Benedict Cumberbatch to basically really, really sell, you know, but when it got sort of ridiculous, you know, to sell the sort of lines and to make this, like, you know, really, really good. And acting wise, and I'm real looking forward as well to Dark World because that's got a cast just as strong as that. And yeah, as a whole film, you know, a excellent experience and worked really. I wasn't sure how Doctor Strange would fit into the Marvel Universe with that Benedict Cumberbatch character, but I really think that he will basically, if rumors are that he's going to be in Infinity Wars, which pretty much everybody's in Infinity Wars.
Yeah,
I actually look forward to him being in there, and I also think as well something which I didn't think I'd say going into this. I want to see him in like another Avengers movie. I don't want to just a cameo. I want to see him basically talking to people like Tony Stark and Captain America and stuff like that. You know, I want to see him, you know, be a part of this, because I think I'm really intrigued how he's going to sort of measure up. And I think he's sort of, you know, his personality is going to, you know, work really well interacting with those characters. What else is there? I mean, you know, fault wise, again, it's one of these things. You had Mads Mikkelsen, an actor like him, as the main bad guy, and he was great in what he was basically allowed to do. But it was another case of basically the villain didn't really get a lot of screen time. But you know, his sort of his plot that he had was sort of a little bit different, but it wasn't. Again, it was one of these situations where, you know, the villain, you know, didn't get a great deal to do. It has to be said. That wasn't a strong point. But the scenes that he was in, you know, were really strong. Got to say as well, one thing that I really didn't expect about this film and doesn't come across in any of the trailers is how good the battle scenes were. Because if you watch the trailers, you don't see a lot of the actual sort of battle. You just see sort of the conjuring and things like that. There were several fight scenes in this, and they were top notch. Really good. Imaginative use of the powers and everything. And it's by no means my favourite Marvel movie. It's nowhere near like Captain America Winter Soldier or Captain America Civil War. It's nowhere near those. But it's in with the sort of, you know, the chasing pack, basically. You know, it is a really good movie. And for one that I think could have been a Marvel's movie where you think if they're going to slip up or do one which doesn't quite fit, this will be the one. To me, it all worked really, really well. And I will sort of, I think a lot of people, if they sort of aren't really that excited about this or have reservations, I think a lot of people are going to be pleasantly surprised about this one.
That's good, because I've been one of those skeptical people, just because, you know, you're dealing with Doctor Strange, a character that just, he's been around forever. He hasn't really had a continuing series, just because the character's great, like in a team setting, or if he's like a team up character. But with that said, it's like, I can't imagine him doing a solo film and it being any good. But from what I've heard from you and several other people, that this film delivers in a big way. So I'm sort of glad to hear that. What I had heard from some people, and they may have been just being hyperbolic, but at the same time, I heard some people compare this, like, as the best Marvel movie so far. So the fact that you've sort of scaled that down, it's like, well, it's not as good as perhaps Civil War, the second Cap movie. With that said, that's still pretty good. That's not too bad, Daz, all things considered.
Yeah. I actually think as well, just something to add in there, I think this is – a lot of the Marvel movies nowadays are getting to a stage where you've really got to like the Marvel movies and be invested in the Marvel universe to enjoy. I mean, Civil War, if you're not into Marvel, Civil War's not really got a lot for you because it is basically for the Marvel fans, which is great because they've got a lot of them out there to sort of sustain this. Doctor Strange is a bit different in the fact that I think this is one that people who aren't necessarily Marvel fans can go to and really, really enjoy. Because it's not got – there's the odd reference to Avengers and stuff, but there's not a great deal in there to suggest it's in the Marvel movie. You can really enjoy this as a standalone, you know, magic movie. You know, and I think that's sort of, you know, that's sort of, you know, a good thing for the, you know, for the movie. But yeah, generally speaking, it's you know, I think a lot of people, you know, will enjoy this one. It's a good one.
That's good. I'm sort of delighted to hear that. Considering I was sort of skeptical of the movie, but I'm looking at RottenTomatoes.com right now, and it's sitting at 98%. Considering it's coming out in less than 2 weeks, I have to imagine that's pretty damn good. All right. Our only other news story that we have here is we covered this as well in our comic conversation show as well, but I feel like we wouldn't be doing our due diligence if I didn't get Daz's take on it as well. The recent passing of Steve Dillon over the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, this obviously was a really sad story. And anyone who sort of knows me or has listened to a podcast know that my favorite comic of all time is Preacher.
See, okay, and here's the thing. I do the show with you every week, and I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. It is my favorite. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, but yeah, my favorite comic of all time is Preacher. And Steve Dillon basically drew the entire series. There was a couple of the specials that he didn't draw, but he drew the entire series. And to me, he was as much responsible for that comic's enjoyment as Garth Ennis was. I, looking back, I can't actually think of Preacher being done with anybody else but him, because you know he in his illustrating Preacher, he really made those characters his own. You know, and one of the things that I loved about him, you know, as an artist, he had a very easily accessible, simple look on the face of it, looking style, mm-hmm. you know, that I think that you could really get into. And one of the things I always loved about his drawings is the expressions on people's faces. In Preacher, there is so much dialogue and so much sort of personality in the dialogue. And he was basically, whenever a character was talking, the picture that he did was always perfect to the actual, you know, to the tone of or what they were actually meant to be saying. And even sometimes when there wasn't any dialogue, when we're just sort of like, you know, because there's a lot of comedy in Preacher, a lot of sort of like, you know, things which relied on his visual, you know, expressions to, you know, express the, you know, what was going on. You know, bits where like characters were expressing shock. I mean, I always remember the pivotal scene in Preacher where Jesse's talking to the lady, Jodie behind the counter, and he suddenly realizes that it's his mom. And there's just a couple of pictures where he's looking at her and just like sort of look at her like more closely as if he's not seen her before, and then he just says mom, and the expression of shock on his face, it's just absolutely beautiful. And stuff like when a character would smile, they'd just be like, so there's just a way that he brought life to that character, like the one scene where you know, Jesse's smiling and he gets, He says he's going to be the sheriff of the town, and this little smile he gets on his face, and just things like that. He just brought so much life to those characters in the expressions, and he was like, and setting a mood for a scene. I mean, for example, there's one scene where Jesse gets his powers back, and he's striding away from this room. He's basically going to beat up all the his grandmother's henchmen. And just it's the very John Wayne moment. He's sort of, and as he's, the stance that he has and the look on his face, it's just a perfect for that mode, which sort of express him and sort of, you know, the kick ass thing that's gonna come around. And it just had this like really great view of sort of, if you actually just look at the pictures that he did and not read the dialogue, they just tell a story by itself. Mm-hmm. You know, and the thing is that Preacher was quite a difficult comic to illustrate because there's so much of it which is just dialogue and conversation. And people talking to, you know, people talk like, there'd be like pages of people just like in a van or at a bar, just talking to each other. And you would basically, you know, you would think that you're actually watching a moving film just by, you know, going through his illustrations. And he was, and sort of things like, you know, it's sort of the way he would draw like, backgrounds and sort of, you know, but the final few pages of Preacher when it's sort of people look into the sunset and everything, just a real almost like a Lawrence of Arabia, if you ever seen that movie, for its like majesticness of doing backgrounds and stuff. It was just a really great artist. And the other stuff he did as well, I mean, I'm not saying that he's an artist that I would go out my way to buy a book of just because it was his art, but if I saw that he was, you know, illustrating a book, I'd sort of be glad because it's an artist who I loved. I mean, he also did Hellblazer. Mm-hmm. Had a great run of that, you know. And I mean, in the UK, he did a lot of comics. He did a lot for 2000 AD. He did Judge Dredd and everything. And he did Punisher. I mean, the stuff on Punisher was great. I mean, well, another thing he did really well was basically fight scenes and ultra violence. But it was gory, but it was also almost even if it was showing something like people like bleeding and bones being broken and stuff, it was just kind of like it wasn't really gory and explicit, but it was like a subdued way that he did it that just, you know, was really effective. And his expressions, like, you know, people like screaming at each other and stuff and the violence he'd convey, it was just a really great artist all the way around. And he also did a in the Ultimates, I think one of the annuals he did, which was a really great one for me because you got to see him doing people like Captain America and Iron Man and stuff like that and sort of, and just a really sad because he was basically, you know, if I was to sort of sit down and come up with my favorite artist, he'd be one of them. Mm-hmm. You know, and he was sort of, you know, just a really sad story.
Yeah, he passed away at age 54, which you look at that and just, that's way too young. And even though we haven't got all the details of his reason of passing, there's nothing been confirmed, but Garth Ennis told the New York Times that it may have been something to do with a ruptured appendix that he wrote off as food poisoning. So, we still don't have all the details. This happened over the weekend. I have to imagine eventually we're going to get an official story, but yeah, that's all we have to go by right now. And you read something like that and you just cringe because you hate to imagine that's what made him pass. I mean, you don't want to hear anybody like this passing at that age, but from something like that, that's a little depressing.
That's just one of those things where you can basically just write something off like that to something like, say, indigestion or something. I mean, just to put this thing, if he, you know, Dave Meltzer, obviously we both know of Dave Meltzer of the Wrestling Observer. Mm-hmm. He almost died of a situation like that. Because he was taking a trip to Japan and he thought he was basically, he actually went to a hospital because he felt something wrong and he was just told, oh, it's, you know, indigestion and that. And he insisted on getting a second opinion. And then they found out that it was to do with his appendix. And if he hadn't got that, that would have probably killed him.
Yikes.
You know, that's a, sort of one of those, you know, but yeah, that's really sad. But like you said, I mean, it was in his early 50s, and it's obviously so sad, you know, as a human being in passing away. But from an artistic point of view, you think how much more work there was for him to do. You know, he could have been, you know, so much decades that he, you know, of work, of artistry. That he would have basically, you know, gone on to produce, and it's just really sad. I have to say as well, this is one of those things I don't recall for such a long time seeing an artist or a comic book writer have so much of a it was passing got so much media attention. Mm-hmm. You know, even like sort of like newspapers and magazines that don't normally carry sort of, you know, comic news and stuff, have basically sort of done features on him and everything and paid tribute and everything. And basically, it's just a really, really sad story.
Yeah. You were mentioning the stuff that he was still drawing. In fact, on my Comics Conversation show, where we covered the current Punisher series, and he was the artist on it. So the idea that, you know, he was this artist and he was off doing other things, it's no, he was still drawing, and he was still drawing comics for Marvel Comics, no less. And for him just to pass away over a weekend, it's really sad. Yeah, you hate to hear something like this, and then of course you hear about like maybe other people dying at their. I mean, obviously, me and Alex had fun with it. I don't know if you're familiar with, but the comic strip artist. Are you? I don't even know if that's the term you'd want to use. The propagandist artist, Jack Chick, who wrote all these pamphlet comic books about all the evils of the world. Obviously, an extreme kind of Christian point of view, lived to see 91. So it's like, you hate to hear something like that, because it's like, okay, I wonder, had he gone to the doctor? Like I said, we're just speculating here. We don't know if that's the exact term, that's the exact reason why he passed away. But it's like, he had so many decades in front of him, and he was such a great artist. You could imagine he could have gone for another 20, 30, maybe even 40 years. So you hate to hear something like that.
Yeah, but just, you know, just sort of, just finally, just want to say, you know, Steve Diller, you know, rest in peace, and just thank you for the basically, you know, the awesome work that you did in entertaining people. Because like I said, I've said many times, Preach was something that was like a really special comic to me, and he, like I say, he was as much responsible for that as Garth Ennis was for creating such an amazing piece of work that for 5 years meant a hell of a lot to you, to me, and in many ways, sort of, you know, possibly got me back into comics at a time when I'd sort of lapsed. So, you know, to Steve Diller, you know, thank you for sort of, you know, such a sharing your amazing talent with us for this wonderful career.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay. Can I just go back to this guy that you just mentioned? This who was it?
Oh, you'll have tons of fun with him. Dazza, Jack Chick.
Okay, so you mentioned propaganda. What did this guy actually do? Because I might have something to say about this guy.
He would write these comic book pamphlets, like they'd be like little flip books, and they would expound the dangers. And it was always the most absurd things. Obviously, the one most people will point to would be the one where he points out the evils and the dangers of playing D&D and how it leads to satanicism. So it's like, okay. It's one of these things to where I even was thinking, it's like, it's weird that the one guy who wrote the book about Preacher, sort of, I guess, lampooning to a degree religion, he passes a very early age, and the propagandist comic artist manages to make it to 91. It's a little disconcerting, but I will say this, people are missing Steve Dillon, whereas the Jack Chick passing away is a bit of a joke.
Yeah, the reason why I wanted to elaborate on that is I actually don't know this guy's name, but I mean, I've said this many times. I work in a bookshop, and at certain times we've had not so much a problem, but we've had people who come into the children's section in the bookshop and will basically leave these little comics.
Yep, that doesn't surprise me.
In the shop, and it happens a lot at Halloween, around about this time at Halloween. Because there's basically a few of the comics were basically out the dangers of Halloween, and these comics were absolutely disgusting. I mean, really sickening. I mean, but one of them was sort of, one of them that I remember is basically sort of this kid who goes to a Halloween like theme park, and then basically ends up sort of like afterwards ends up in hell. And then there's another one where this like teacher's doing like talking to this class about God, and this little boy puts his hands up and says, "My friend Jimmy was a really, really good person, but he died. But his parents didn't believe in God. Will he still be able to get into heaven?" And then the teacher just says, No, I'm afraid not. Little Jimmy will be burning in hell now because he didn't believe in God. And then there's like a picture of this like little kid sort of like dying on the, you know, in, well, basically sort of, you know, being tortured in hell. And these are like what you've described, the really little sort of, you know, really little tiny comics. But they're just so insidious. And I'll tell you another time we used to get them. Whenever the Harry Potter book would be released, we would find them in the shop then. Because obviously we used to get, I'm probably not supposed to talk about this actually, because we're not supposed to slag customers off on in social media. But then again, these aren't real customers. These are nutcases. We would basically sort of try to get, basically tell us that we were spreading evil by, stocking Harry Potter books and things, and we will get these comics left in there. But what we'll do as well, which was really, really, really sickening, is we want to just leave them in the, it, like, you know, for people to find, we'd actually hide them in books so that, you know, kids would basically buy, you know, books, or somebody would buy their kid a book, and then they'd be at home and the little kids reading it, and then they come across this comic stuck in the pages. So from what you describe, I'm going to have to sort of check this guy's work out, but it sounds like the sort of stuff that, you know, we get hit with we've been hit with in the past sometimes.
Further proof that there's no justice in this world.
A piece of crap who's spreading hatred and, you know, and intolerance and, you know, sort of, and let's face it, fear mongering, you know, sort of trying to frighten children and stuff like that. He gets to live to a 90, and, you know, something like Steve Dillon, who's basically, you know, entertaining people and doing something positive and creative with his life, he passes away too soon. It's, But like you say, no one's missing this guy right now. You know, the Westboro Baptist Church.
That's pretty much what he is. I think Alex made the comparison to that, and it's like, we're not here ripping on people of religious institutions if you're that of faith.
No.
But really, like you said, these are the extreme. These are the people, like you said, the West Baptist Church. It's that extreme. So, you know, people are with their tongue in cheek. It's like, oh yeah, it's a shame that they passed away. let's talk something less controversial. Let's talk something more lighthearted. Let's talk Freight and Slate for the year of 1995. Now, obviously, these top 10 films are from TKO170.com. These are the top 10 performing films for 1995. Let's start at number 10 with Waterworld. Number 9, Jumanji. Number 8, Casper. Number 7, Apollo 13. Number 6, Batman Forever. Number 5, Pocahontas. Number 4, Seven. Number 3, Goldeneye. Number 2, Toy Story, and at number 1 for 1995's top 10 performing films, according to box office receipts at TKO170.com, Die Hard with a Vengeance. Dazza, what is your rate for this week?
My rate for this week is Apollo 13.
Ooh, nice.
I have to say, I'm a real sucker for sort of like, you know, adaptations of true events and true stories and stuff. And this one, I absolutely love this film. Mm-hmm. You know, it's great performances across the board. It's a, you know, it's amazing cast. I mean, you've got Tom Hanks, you got Kevin Bacon, you've got Ed Harris putting in an absolute, you know, great performance. It's one of those. It reminds me of the old disaster movies where they would just get, like, you know, a massive, like, you know, really good cast of people. And the story as well is absolutely fascinating. And one of the things that I love about this film is from the accident happening and the whole sort of quest to get them back and everything. Everything is about intelligence. It's all about problem solving and people working together and people using their brains and stuff like that. It's not like a disaster movie where you're having to sort of, like, you know, you know, use your physical attributes and sort of, you know, and climb over sort of fires and all that sort of thing. It's everything about this. So I remember some people saying now they hated it because it was all like watching the what they describe as the eggheads, you know, sort of saving the day and everything like that. I'm the opposite. I think it's great because of that. You know, because it's basically, you know, sort of, you know, people sort of, you know, you know, so using their brains to sort of, you know, come up with it, and he sort of celebrates intelligence. But there's across the board, I just I think there's so many moments of great tension in this movie. I mean, you know, there's stuff like when we first get the, you know, the accident, and the war basically sort of is like sort of like that panic, and when we saw some moment when they mentioned how they can see the gas float into space, and the Nova's like a really serious problem here, and everyone just goes quiet, and we just all look at the screen in shock, and then just as one, everybody just reacts and goes right into action mode, you know. And Ed Harris is the sort of the leader and everything, but there's a great scene I always love where they get a message from President Nixon saying how he wants odds on what the chances are getting the crew alive. Mm-hmm. And Ed Harris just comes back, just says, we're not losing the crew. Nice. It's just like a non-fit. It's just, there's so many really cool, great speech and action moments in this film. And it's just, I just think it's absolutely a wonderful story. It was really, really told really well. And just actually, funnily enough, it was on TV here the other day, and I started watching it for a bit, and ended up watching the whole thing again. It's just absolutely sort of, you know, gripping and everything, and just a fascinating story. Which, of course, some people will have you claim never actually happened.
That's wacky, Dazza. All right, I'm looking at this top 10, and obviously, it's not like earlier years in the 90s where it was absolutely stacked. I really couldn't pick one film or another, but still there's some films. Obviously I want to do some notables. They're not even close to my rate, but there are honorable mentions, like Jumanji. I think is a great film. If you haven't already, I'd recommend you check it out. Dazza, have you heard the news of them doing a remake of that?
Yes. I've seen the photographs as well, cause The Rock's, I believe, is in it. Isn't Jack Black as well?
I believe Rock and Jack Black are the two big names yeah. attached to that film so far.
And they've released a photo of them in the gear and everything. There's four of them there. So yeah, so they've started to basically. But yeah, that's the reboot.
Yeah, that's a fun film. And if you have that film with those two, it's not going to be the same film. Obviously, the one with Robin Williams.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you have to imagine it still may be good. It still has a pretty good central story there. So I'm kind of looking forward to that. But like I said, that's not going to be my rate, because you look at this lineup, and while it's a good film, it's not really the one I'd probably go with. Another honorable mention would probably be the animated film Pocahontas. It's something I watched as a kid, and I think you can sort of watch as an adult now and appreciate the animation, the musical sequences, and still get a lot of enjoyment out of that. Another thing that I'd be surprised that I didn't pick for my rate, but also Toy Story, the first computer-generated film. Obviously, you go back and look at this, and all things considered, this was 1995. The what they were able to do with the computers at the time was absolutely spectacular. So, but with that said, I'm probably going to go with the James Bond film Goldeneye, just because it's has such a fondness to it, just because it was one of the very few James Bond films I'd watch. I'd later go on to watch later entries of the film because of this. I like it because it's, of all the 007 films, they tend to be these, you know, these big major motion pictures where it's the glitz and the glamour of being an international agent. And this sort of seemed like the grittier version of that. Like, it still had obviously all the stuff that you expect from a James Bond film, but this was the first one in quite a while that actually was very gritty and down to earth, and eventually you'd get that in later iterations. But I absolutely love this film, and I'd be remiss if I hadn't mentioned the I don't know if you ever played back in the day, Dazza, but the N64 game that was based off of this was absolutely spectacular. One of the best games of all time. If you're talking a console shooter, you'd be remiss not to mention this book if you're talking the N64. So I'm picking this film based entirely off its merits as a film, but I'd be remiss if I hadn't mentioned that they also managed to make a spectacular video game about it, and it's an absolute classic. And Dazza, have you played the game? I know you're of a certain generation that stopped playing video games a while ago, so I'm curious, was this the cutoff point, or were you at this point you'd stop playing video games?
I've heard nothing but good things about that game, but I never had a Nintendo, so I think I I had a Sega Mega Drive, and I, when I sort of picked up games again, I got a PlayStation. So I never got the GoldenEye game, but everything I heard about it was that it was pretty great and stuff. And was it one of the first games to have like a multiplayer shooting up aspect?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, but the film itself, I mean, this kind of sort of got the James Bond films back on track somewhat. It was, I really liked this one. You know, when I went to the cinema to see it, I really liked it. It was sort of like, you know, a refreshing change. Having a female M was sort of, you know, shook things up and everything. And it also was sort of very, it was one of the James Bond films for quite a long time, and we'll probably get more into this when we finally get around to doing our James Bond episode, we sort of like got involved in the political scene, which a lot of the James Bond films were a lot had sort of like, you know, hadn't sort of addressed for some time, whereas this one addressed the whole thing of the sort of like the Berlin Wall falling and the sort of, you know, the end of the sort of the USSR and everything. And you just sort of, you know, the redundancy of the sort of for a while at least, the sort of, you know, the secret agency type thing. So, yeah, I thought this was a really good one.
Yeah. I'd be hard-pressed to... Yeah.
I mean, there are some good ones on this list. I've got to say another one, which... Surprised looking at the Halloween special that we just did. I completely forgot about Seven.
Yeah,
which that's... you know, that's another film which I don't think I could ever watch again, because the ending is for a start, it's a very sort of heavy film anyway, brilliant but heavy, and the ending is such an absolute downer. And the thing is, the sort of the telegraph when he turns up with the box, after you sort of realise where it's going with this, and it does, it's just horrific. You know, it's such a downer of that final scene. But yeah, that's a great film.
Yeah, I'm looking over the rest of this list, because often what I'll do is I'll do some honorable mentions for films in 1995. Here I have Bad Boys with Will Smith and Martin Lawrence. That was a good film. sorry, I'm looking at this. And Get Shorty, that was a fun, enjoyable film for what it was. I guess I sort of have the nostalgics. You know, I can't sit here and defend this film on its merits alone. But the, you know, of all of, in the history of video game movies, Mortal Kombat I think was one of the better ones.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at this. Oh, 12 Monkeys. Have you seen that film, Dazza?
That's great.
If we had done, let's see, top 25, that probably would have been the film I would have gone with, because love that film.
Yeah, that's a really good one.
Heat. Another honorable
Heat is awesome. I absolutely love Heat. That is just amazing. I mean, that was a film that I got, goosebumps in the scene where Al Pacino and Robert De Niro are on the same, the same screen doing that scene. It's just like one scene where they're together, and I just ate that shit up so much. it was such. But that whole film is great. You know, it's sort of, you know, there's so many sort of subplots and everything, and yeah, that's a really great film.
Yeah, there's a
another one so far down the list as well, which is Casino.
Ah,
which I love that. I mean, everyone talks about Goodfellas, and Goodfellas is great, but I'd put Casino pretty much on a par with it. You know, it's in some ways. I mean, in some ways, it's almost it got elements of the same story. You know, with so many of the cast, but yeah, I love Casino. I thought that film was awesome. You know.
Okay,
it was also included on my article on the greatest ass kicking scenes.
Oh, nice.
So yes, but yeah, there's some good ones on this. Obviously, I think you know, the 90s generally has been a lot stronger than the 80s going through all this.
Yeah, you know, that's the one thing I noticed. We went over the 80s films, and yeah, we would get classic films, we'd get really good films, but it'd often be sparsed out. We'd maybe get one or two, maybe even three really top-notch films in a year in the 80s, but when you're looking at here at the 90s, you know, it's really top notch, and it's almost, it's really hard to pick one, because there's just often when you look at the top 10, it's like, you could pick this one and you'd be totally justified and that in your rate. You could pick that and you'd be totally justified with your rate. In fact, I think there were years where I was just like, I can't pick a bad, there's not a bad film in this bunch. That would not be the case this year. Moving on to Slate. Dazza, I'm curious. I mean, there's so many ways you can go with this. So I'm curious to see which way you decide to go, because there are in fact a few stinkers in this list.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, there's only one that I would really sort of say I really, really dislike, and that would be Batman Forever. I remember really looking forward to this movie, because it just looks, on the trailers, it just looks so much fun. I mean, you had Jim Carrey in there as the Riddler, and Tommy Lee Jones as Two-Face. It just looked colourful, lots of fun, and it just didn't work. I mean, for a start, they have the wrong Batman. You know, what's his name?
Val Kilmer.
Val Kilmer. Mm-hmm. He was just so bland in this movie.
Yeah.
You know, he was just, you need a Bruce Wayne who has, for a start, Bruce Wayne is a character that you need to have some depth to him, because he's basically insane. You know, you've got to have that sort of dark, you've got to be able to someone who can do the dark and do the obsessive and do the sort of like the bit of a mystery, but also do the sort of a charm as well, you know, the dual personality. And Val Kilmer just had absolutely nothing. He just brought nothing to the table. It was almost as if he didn't know what to do with the character. The villains, just again, I mean, like, Jim Carrey was probably the best thing to look at watching it in the film, but it just didn't work. The whole thing didn't work. You know, I mean, if Tommy Lee Jones at that time was just, he could make anything awesome, and for him basically not to be good in this film, it takes a sort of feat. And it kind of went back to the campy Batman days, but still trying to be sort of like the edgy violence and stuff. And I absolutely was so disappointed in this movie. In fact, it was really weird that I went to see Judge Dredd the week later.
You poor soul.
Yeah. But the thing is, at the time, compared to Batman Forever, I actually thought Judge Dredd was actually watchable.
Wow.
Compared to Batman Forever. And Nicole Kidman as well was just horrible. It just felt really campy, but not in a really fun way either. This was not a good one. And they still persevered with this direction. This you know, they still went with another one afterwards. But yeah, I was this one was not a good a good part of the franchise.
I remember when this came out in 1995. Obviously I was a kid, considerably younger than I am now. I watched this as a kid, and I thought it was fine. In fact, I kind of liked it. I mean, obviously, I didn't like it more than the previous two entries in the Batman series. But with that said, I watched as a kid, and I was like, "Hey, this is fine. This is what I expect Batman to be to a certain degree." But then, as I would get older, and I'd hear the people snicker when I mentioned Batman Forever, and then I recently watched as, I guess maybe a couple of years ago, just to see if. I mean, I kind of knew and I sort of dismissed it. I was like, well, now that I think about it, that this may not have been a great film. And it's one of those things where I since then gone back and watched. And you're right. It is a pretty bad film. Something like this, you would hope they would. Because, you know, obviously, like I mentioned earlier, as a kid I watched and I didn't think it was fine. But a film like this, a giant blockbuster, you would hope that it would appeal to everybody. And for it to just completely sour me once I got to a certain age, and I have to imagine even adults when they were watching this when they came out, soured on the film. It's like, well, I don't know what they were going for considering the other two films that had been so great. There was that blueprint there already. It seemed like it was a license to print money. And obviously, I don't think this hurt considering it was in the top 10. But with that said, it's like, oh, come on. It's like, really? You had a winning formula. You had pretty much a license to print money, and you screwed it up by doing something so off the beaten trail. It's like people liked something from Batman, the idea that you're going to go in there and completely change up the formula for no reason at all. It's like I can't imagine. Obviously, I don't have the numbers in front of me right now, but I have to imagine at this point the Batman movie franchise had been doing particularly well, and I imagine that the sequel Batman Returns probably was an improvement based off the box office of the first one. So the idea that you'd come with, and obviously I'm looking at the director here, I'm pulling it up here on IMDb, Joel Schumacher, who would also direct the sequel. It's like, I understand, like, money-wise why you'd want to go in a different direction and why you would want to recast people. But with that said, it's like, oh, man. It's one of those situations where maybe you should have spent the money because you probably would have made it back, but then also you would have had the much better film. The only real, you know, you watch this film, and the only real thing that I could sort of say, obviously, as an adult, some of it you cringe at, but for the most part, I'd say the one shiny thing, the one takeaway from this film would be Jim Carrey's performance as the Riddler. I mean, for the most part, I'd say this film is completely throwaway, but Jim Carrey in this I thought was serviceable.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, incidentally, when we sort of talked about why, you know, the actual change in direction, I'm guessing that one of the reasons why they sort of changed the sort of, you know, the scheme is that they probably wanted to basically be able to market this, not so much more to kids as a film, but basically open up the doors to merchandising and licensing deals and stuff, which was sort of like, you know, started to be the big thing in movies.
But you mean tell me they didn't do it in the first Batman movies? I remember as a child growing up, I had tons of Batman Return toys. So the idea of that they were waiting for this film to do it, it's like, no, that's a little absurd. I think what happened is they saw dollar signs from the first two Batman films, and they decided, well, let's see if we can cut back and see if the quality will still be there. Because obviously you see this with movies when actors are negotiating for sequel after sequel, their bargaining position gets stronger and stronger. So I understand why the studio would go in a different direction with the cast and the director, but at the same time, it's like, well, maybe you should have stuck with it, because eventually you'd get later on, and I'm getting a little ahead of myself here, but you would get Batman and Robin. That would sort of sour the movie going public on superhero movies, at least as far as a big blockbuster is concerned, for quite a while, which is a shame considering now we're getting all these films where I guess they're essentially playing catch up, but it would have been nice had they had not poisoned the well and held off on superhero films for so long.
But the only bits that sort of stick out for me being really, really good, like I said, Jim Carrey, but one of the lines he has where basically sort of crashed and tried to take over this party, and Batman makes his entrance, and Batman turns around to Two-Face and says, "Your entrance was good, his was better." And I always like that line. And also, Sugar and Spice were pretty cool in it. Do you remember Sugar and Spice in this?
No.
Drew Barrymore.
That
scene was pretty decent. That was
the two women for Two-Face. Yeah,
that had the suit. Yeah, yeah. Drew Barrymore is the sort of, you know, in the white stockings and everything. That would that work for me.
I wonder why. All right, since we're talking all things cinema, we picked our rate and slate. I don't know if you can tell from me. I'm gonna go with Batman Forever as well as my slate. We talked the worst of the worst. Let's compare our let's see what won Best Picture in 1996. Daza, any guesses to what it was?
I think I remember this because I'm just going down the list, and I think Braveheart won.
You would be correct, Daza.
Yeah, I sort of remember because this is in the years before Mel Gibson lost his mind and basically started saying lots of things that he shouldn't have said and was sort of, you know. So I remember Braveheart, which a really great film, you know, really epic and everything. Absolutely bollocks history wise. I mean, the idea that William Wallace got the the future Queen of England pregnant. And all this sort of thing, and it was a romance. Total rubbish. But yeah, just, you know, for me, a really great, memorable film. Also, awesome battle scenes as well. I mean, absolutely incredible film.
There you go. All right, we talked the best of the best. Let's talk the worst of the worst. Let's look at the Golden Razzies, the 16th annual Golden Razzie, to be specific, for the year of 1995. Obviously, I'm going to do my gimmick that we always do, where I rattle off the worst picture nominations, and Dazza tries to guess which it is. I think this year may be a no-brainer, but you'd be surprised. Nominations we have are Congo. It's Pat. Oh, that's not fair. The Scarlet Letter. Showgirls and Waterworld. That's some stiff competition towards the end.
I'm torn between two what it could be. I'm going to go with Showgirls.
You would be correct, Dazza.
Is it right? Okay.
I was looking at this list. I'm like, you could conceivably go in either direction, because Waterworld was also pretty bad, too.
I didn't think Waterworld was that bad. I think the thing about Waterworld that really got the ire of people and sort of got so much attention was the fact it was so expensive. I think it was seen, you know, there was all these like really stupid stories coming out, like, and all these like weird statistics where they said, you know, you could have used the budget for Waterworld to buy everybody in Australia a hamburger or something. It was always like really weird things. And at the time, Kevin Costner again was sort of like it was like the whipping boy, let's face it, of Hollywood at the time. You know, it's sort of, you know, so it doesn't surprise. I'm not saying it was a good film. I don't think it particularly was. But at the same time, I don't think it was absolutely horrible. I think it was just the sort of, it was one of the first films that was seen as sort of so massively expensive and basically didn't deliver it back. But I think actually, I don't think it was a box office bomb. I think even despite the amount of money it spent, it did make it back, you know. So, yeah. But yeah, it was a bit. Yeah, Showgirls was Showgirls was quite. It was really weird because it was one of those films that was sort of meant to be like really titillating and everything, and it was just so. There was just these like really plastic look, even though you're seeing like lots of like naked women constantly and stuff like that. It was just done in a way that was just almost off-putting. It was like just sort of like ridiculous and like really unsexy. It was a really strange film and just really tacky. Sort of, you know, for a film that was basically meant to be seen as a film that was going to be basically sort of groundbreaking because it was, you know, sort of, you know, so sexy and everything. But yeah, it was just a really, really massively tacky film.
Yeah, I can see why it would be the worst picture here. This is one of these instances where we've had the Golden Razzies, and it kind of seems like they're being catty. They're picking on films that don't necessarily deserve it. This seems like a film that's custom made for the Razzies. Obviously, you would see later iterations. Obviously, worst actress would also be Elizabeth Berkley and Showgirls. I'm looking at this down the list.
That film pretty much destroyed her career.
Yeah, for the most part.
I think because she at the time it was like I think it was a first movie because she was like she was and one of the things that basically sort of didn't do any favors. It was quite a jump because she was in like one of these like was it like Saved by the Bell or something like that. It was one of these like kids shows, like these like teenage shows. So she was seen like as a child star. So for her to basically go straight into a film where she was basically sort of, you know, naked and riding on people and everything, and it was just a it was a really bad film all around. I do remember this really weird scene where she takes revenge on a guy who's assaulted and raped a friend, and she basically she's like beating him up, but she's topless when she's doing it. So she's like kicking him with these high heel bones, and the tits are wobbling everywhere and everything. It's just a really bizarre film. I've got to admit, I miss it when you mentioned. You mentioned one of them as being not fair. Which film did you say? You were reading this list out.
Obviously, I hadn't watched it, but the based off the SNL character, the It's Pat movie.
Oh, okay.
Like, I'm sure it wasn't great, but considering it a worse picture, I mean, just the character alone and the idea that you're going to do a movie based off that, it's probably a bad idea, but to say worst picture nomination, it's like, well, that's not necessarily fair. You kind of knew what you were getting with that film.
I have a story about The Scarlet Letter. I didn't go to see The Scarlet Letter, but I went to see a film. It might even have been Waterworld I went to see, but before that, VHS trailer for The Scarlet Letter. And there's this scene that's looking from the top down onto this like pond, and you see this naked figure swimming from above, and the figure's got this long, beautiful dark hair and this sort of, you know, this body, and then, you know, this sort of, you see the person's naked and the, you see the person's arse. And I remember somebody, these like teenagers sitting a few rows back from me, and they see this sort of naked person swimming across the screen, and hear them going, oh, oh gosh, she's gorgeous. You know, Demi Moore, oh, she's naked, that's her arse and everything like that. And then in the next scene, you basically see the person get out of the pond, and it's actually Gary Oldman.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Let's see. Other notables on this list are Pauly Shore, Worst Actor, and Jury Duty, which I take question with. No, I'm kidding.
Oh God, yeah. That, I've never seen a film with him in it. Because he was just so absolutely irritating. He was one of these. I think we're sort of trying to go for like an edgier version of Wayne's World, you know, that sort of character, but with a bit more sort of like, you know, a bit more of a sort of. I don't know, just a bit more of a sort of like, you know, a nastier edge to him, but still that sort of character. But yeah, that just that character. Any film that he was in, and it wasn't around that long. It didn't really, you know, work. But I totally kept away from cinemas if he was in a film.
Yeah, I'm looking at this, and we were mentioning Showgirls earlier, and that's absolutely what's sweeping. The Razzies. You have Worst Screenplay, Worst New Star, and Elizabeth Berkley. Walk Into the Winds, Worst Original Song. Just up and down, Worst Director, Worst On-Screen Couple. So it sweep the Razzies, and you. This is the first instance I remember way back when. I think this was the first time I'd ever heard of the Razzies mentioned. They obviously had been around for 15 years prior to this, but this is the first time I kind of heard of them existing. So,
I think this is one of those instances where you had a film that was just sort of so universally bad. I mean, there's so many scenes and really really bad lines in it. I mean, there's that notorious sex scene in the swimming pool. Which, you know, where somebody sort of worked out was like totally impossible to actually achieve, and it is just a really really awful, you know, crash film. I'm just looking down the our old friend Madonna's in there for Worst Supporting Actress in Four Rooms.
Oh,
that was a film we. Quentin Tarantino actually had a party mat. It was basically four stories set in a hotel, and the trick was that each one would be done. Each story would be done by a different director. And Quentin Tarantino did a thing in there, and it was absolutely awful. What else have we got? Bo Derek in there again. We know her, of course. We've had her a few times on there. Congo. God, tell me, I've never actually seen Congo. So
you're not missing out on much, Dad.
No. Worst New Star, Cindy Crawford. I do remember she never made another one. Ooh, Hold Me, Thrill Me, Kiss Me, Kill Me for Batman Forever nominated for Worst Song. So, yeah.
Yeah, and you brought up earlier The Scarlet Letter, that won Worst Remake or Sequel, so... At least it got its own. All right. I feel like we've talked about bad movies enough as it is, Dazza. I know we talked to you watching Doctor Strange. Have you checked out anything else since the last time we did our show?
I've checked out quite a few films, actually.
Excellent. That always makes for a good time.
Yeah. One of them was quite a strange film, actually, in a number of ways. And I think it's getting a mixed response from audiences, but I really, really liked it. And that was American Honey, which was a little independent film. And it's basically, the story of it is that there's a young girl who's basically sort of got a pretty much a life looking after someone else's kids in a downtrodden relationship and not much going through her life. And she basically hooks up with this group of young people, basically traveling across America and selling magazine subscriptions. And that's pretty much the story of the film. There's not actually that much more to it. And it's a really, for a story like that, it's a really, really long film. I mean, it's around about 3 hours. And the scenes in it, which are, there's a lot of scenes where you there's times you'll basically just be like in the bus with these characters, just sort of listening to music and sort of talking about, you know, nonsense. But for some reason, I really liked it. It's just got this beautiful vibe to it, even though there's not a lot going on at times. It's just got, it's almost like an on the road for sort of like, you know, a younger generation of today. And it's got Shia LaBeouf in it, who's basically plays the head guy of the sort of, you know, he's like the bestseller of all these sort of, you know, people on this thing. And it's just something about it that was just sort of like, you know, just a really nice story, but sort of quite tragic in a few places as well. And this girl sort of, you know, just trying to make a way in the world and just everything. But for some reason, it was just it's something which was a great story, but the film itself just looked beautiful. It's really hard to describe. I can see a lot of people watching this and just sat there thinking, what is this about? There's absolutely nothing going on. But to me, I just found this just like a really nice sort of, you know, vibe to it. And I didn't mind sitting there for 3 hours, even though afterwards, if you tell me the stuff that went on, there's not a lot. She falls for Shia LaBeouf. He sort of strings her along a bit and sort of, you know, and they have a bit of a relationship, but it doesn't really work out. And she has problems with the boss of the boss of the group and everything, but generally speaking, I was really glad I went to see this film, and just a really nice little independent film. I also went to see another film, totally different vibe, called The Blood Father, which was a action film with Mel Gibson and very low budget, and not like a spectacular action film with sort of like people, you know, diving over things or anything like that. But basically the plot of it was his daughter went missing when he was, he was in prison and she was never found. And she turns up out of the blue and she's got herself mixed up with his gang, and they're basically out to kill her because she's basically been, she's got into a situation where she's almost killed a gang boss's son. And so she goes on the run and she basically meets up with her father, and he's basically a recovering alcoholic and he's trying to protect her from these bad guys. It's a very short, low budget action film that just has something about it that was just sort of, you know, fun to watch. You know, Mel Gibson seemed, you know, where I have respect for Mel Gibson about films is he very rarely does a film where he basically just phones it in. Like somebody like Bruce Willis or Steven Seagal, who basically come in and just do their thing. He, even if he's doing a small role, he seems to be into the film. And this one, he brought a lot of character in there and everything. And I, you know, it's not one I'd recommend people, you know, go out of the way to see. But if it shows up on TV or Netflix, or you're in the cinema and you just want to film for 90 minutes, it basically did the job. You know, it wasn't great, but it was no means bad, and was sort of like, you know, really fun in places, and, you know, had a really good set of bad guys as well, which were basically that you really wanted him to have a go at. The one that is probably the star pick of the week, though, was the remake of the Batman and Robin old TV series.
Oh, I hate you so much.
Yeah, this was a real stroke of luck that I managed to actually get to see this film, because it's not a film that is getting a wide release. It was basically just in selected theaters and pretty much for one night only. And it just so happened that this movie came along to a cinema that I go to and just happened to basically be, you know, it was basically one night, one showing, and that's it. And I have to say, I had a really, really great time with this film. It was basically a remake of the old Adam West, Burt Ward, Batman TV series from the 60s. And what I was really impressed by it was it stayed true to that series. The thing about that series as well is people always talk about it as being really, really campy and everything like that. But it was actually a spoof itself. You know, the humor was basically meant to be corny. The characters were being sent up because there were these, like, basically, you know, schoolboy characters, you know, these goody two shoes type. The whole sort of villains were basically deliberately over the top. It was basically meant to be like that. And so these sort of like, it really, because I thought that they may try to basically sex up the humor somewhat and make it more modern. But the humor was very much of the sort, you know, it was basically tied in with the TV shows with a few little in-jokes along the way. Because there was one of the characters who was from the TV show as well, who was like the maid. There was this like in-joke throughout that she suspected that Batman and Robin were gay. And it didn't come out sort of overtly, but she kept doing this little thing that she, when they went off to be Batman and Robin, she had this little thing about her saying, oh, I know what their little secret is and everything. And it was basically, it wasn't explicitly said, but it was basically sort of meant that she basically had this suspicion that they were basically in a relationship. And there was other stuff, there was a really funny joke at the expense of Dark Knight Rises. There was a real little thing on that. But everything about it was just sort of just massively, massively fun. You know, the Catwoman, they actually got Julie Newmar back to voice Catwoman. And it was just, the whole thing was just great. I absolutely, if you are sort of, if you have an affection for the original TV show, you would really, really enjoy this. It basically did, it ticked off all the boxes. You had a sort of, what they would do in the Batman series is they would have a bit where they'd be sort of tied to some sort of like ridiculous contraption that was going to kill them. And in this, you had that as well. And they came up with a really silly way to actually escape. It was just a really, really great film. If you've ever seen the Batman movie that they made out about, which is one of my personal favorites, it's sort of, and if you enjoyed that, you'd probably enjoy the cartoon. It's really, you know, it's really a, this is a really good one to see, you know, if you are a fan of that TV show. So that's what I've been watching on, Return of the Cape. I've just been trying to remember what the title is. It's Return of the Cape Crusaders. And I'm pretty sure that it'll be doing like what we did with like Killing Joke. It'll be on DVD soon or on sort of some streaming channel, but I definitely recommend having an evening with that film. It was really, really good.
Here's the weird thing. Considering the nature of this film, how it was shown on a limited day, only one day over here, I'm looking at it right now, and I was looking at when I was doing research, it's like, well, when can I buy this film? Because I really want to see it. I want to own it. It's out on digital download right now. I could pay to watch it right now, but I think it doesn't come out till DVD for another couple of weeks, which I always find that odd, because it's like I could have the film digitally right now, or I could wait to get the physical. And no offense, God bless the physical stuff, but if I want to see the film, I want to see it now. I want to own it now. So I'm not going to sit around and wait for a physical DVD to make its way to stores.
They've started to do that in the UK as well. On the satellite channels, you can download, but for generally speaking, they basically have it so you can download and watch the films or rent the films now.
But ahead of the physical release?
Yes, yeah.
Huh.
It seems to be quite a common thing. Some of them have actually doing the best of both worlds as well, where you can basically, if you sort of, you can buy it as a package. So you get to watch it as many times as you want streaming. And then when the DVD comes out, you get sent a copy of the DVD. That seems to be something they've started doing as well.
Huh. It's amazing time we live in, Dazza.
I personally, I'm with you. If I'm buying something, I want some sort of physical. Because the Batman v Superman, the special edition, the longer, by all accounts, better cut, you can only get on Blu-ray, which I don't have a Blu-ray. I still just got the DVD. And you can actually rent it on, you can basically buy it on like Amazon Prime to sort of watch whenever you want by streaming. Mm-hmm. But if I'm going to buy it, I kind of want some sort of, want it physically, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's strange, even though I could watch it anytime I wanted by paying and streaming. I don't mind doing a streaming service like Netflix or Amazon Prime's video thing where you can basically just choose video, you know, whatever you want. But if I'm actually going to pay singly to own a film, I actually want to own it physically. I don't just want to have it basically like in the cloud or whatever they call it. Well, one thing I've got to say about Return of the Crusaders as well, and I don't know anything about the background of the making of this film. I was really surprised that they had Burt Ward and Adam West in this, because from all accounts I've heard they hate each other.
Well, the way with voiceovers work is that they very easily could just record all of Adam West's stuff and then
that's what I was thinking. That they had him basically in separate, doing recordings at separate times and stuff. But yeah, because I heard that if there's been instances where they've both been at like comic cons and stuff, and that they had a thing which sounds really petty, I don't know if it's true or not, but they would actually, if somebody brought them some merchandise and they had the other signature on, they'd refuse to sign it. they had such a big falling out that they refused to do that. But
there you go.
So that's the movies I've been watching. But just to throw something in, another little thing in there, there's a TV series that is basically getting a lot of buzz on Netflix at the moment, and it's been in the UK for a long time, called Black Mirror. Mm-hmm. And I think you'd kind of like this as well. It's basically done by a guy called Charlie Brooker, who's a comedian in this country, and it's got a very horror theme to it. And it's almost like a Twilight Zone type feel to it. Every episode is like a different story. But it's also to stories about sort of like culture today, and in particular the media. And the third season is basically, before they've always been on UK TV, but this latest season is basically like, I think it's a Netflix exclusive, so it's just dropped on there. And it's, if you ever fancy like watching a really good TV drama, like a one episode story type thing, this is one to go for, because it's absolutely excellent. All of them are sort of about sort of society today. So I've watched the first episode of the latest season, and it's basically about a society where everybody is basically constantly rating each other, like you would rate someone's photographs, mm-hmm. or rate someone, and because of that, you basically get a rating. So, if for example you go to a coffee shop, you basically sort of, when you interact with the person behind the counter, afterwards you give them a rating, and then there's like an aggregate score of that person, and the person behind the coffee shop would give a rating as well of you, yep. And the higher a rating you are, the better a person you seem. So, for example, there'll be like jobs that you can get because your rating is higher and stuff.
Yeah, I know there was something in real life that was similar to that. I think it was called People, PEEPLP.
Right.
It was exactly what you were mentioning there, where it was a wave to review people. Often it'd often be like, I guess you would say, maybe like in a relationship kind of situation. If someone's nuts, you could look the butt up and maybe cut it off the past, or ask them what's the deal, why do they have bad reviews online. But that does sound pretty cool.
Yeah, it's a real good story, because the main thing of it is that there's a woman who basically her life starts to fall apart because she starts getting a few bad reviews. Mm-hmm. and she starts losing friends and stuff. And he's just one of those. He's Charlie Brooker is basically a is to us he's a great writer. He's a great writer. He writes books on television and stuff like that. But he also does a lot of sort of like, you know, documentary. Well, sort of satirical type documentaries and TV dramas. And I really would recommend all the Black Mirror TV shows, because they've actually, in the UK on Netflix, I'm guessing it's the same over here, they've actually put all the original ones that he did, which were on UK TV, and they're all really, really worth watching. They're sort of some really dark humour, but also sort of like, you know, they've also got like a, you know, not, I won't say quite a message, but they're basically a mirror on, you know, what the world is today. We sort of, and social media is something that crops up a hell of a lot as one of the themes. But yeah, that's the TV show that I really, really recommend at the moment.
Okay. As long as we're talking things that you've sort of you feel like putting spotlight on, is there anything that you've been reading as of late that you also want to put a spotlight on?
Actually realized today, because I've started. Because my place of work has changed, I'm in a different place. I'm actually in a city that doesn't have a comic shop. So I've basically started I found a really cool place that mails out without charging postage, which, you know, there's a lot of these places that sell the copies, the comics cheap, but when you actually look at the postage takes it like to almost a double what you would pay normally. But this is like a really cool place that I've sort of got it from on eBay, a store on there. So I realized actually that most of the stuff that I'm such a regularly getting is DC nowadays. Mm. There's basically one comic that I basically get regularly, which is Marvel, which is Gwenpool, and all the rest are sort of like Harley Quinn, Suicide Squad. The Batman, the one which is written by Tom King, I've become a regular reader of that one.
Yeah.
I ditched the Monsters storyline because I'm not really... I like Batman to be a story which is basically, you know, down to earth as much as you can in superhero thing. So I'm not into him basically fighting monsters or demons or stuff like that. So I ditched that little spin off I did, but I basically got back into it because they've basically done they're doing like a Bane storyline.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got a thing where in this one, Batman was basically like recruiting his own team X type thing, which, you know, I really enjoy the comic. It's nothing massively spectacular, but to me, it's just good superhero fun. And I'm really enjoying it. The ending of it was really weird, though, because it's basically he basically goes down Arkham and he's recruiting basically these people for his like little squad, and it's showing you for each one the what they're as he approaches each one, he's telling you what they're in for and what their sort of like, you know, rap sheet is and stuff. And then it gets to Catwoman at the end, and it mentions that she's got 237 counts of murder,
mm-hmm.
which I kind of didn't quite get, because, you know, but the last time I sort of read Catwoman in a comic, she was kind of she was almost like an anti-hero. She was like you know, sort of sometimes allied with Batman, so I'd never seen her as like a murderer as such. So
well,
that was like
thing they were doing with Catwoman in New 52 prior to Rebirth was this idea that she's a crime boss, so the idea that all these murders are pinned on her is conceivable, and I can see I can see how they try to explain that probably later on issues.
Yeah,
but okay. It's funny you mentioned you like a grounded Batman story, but you have Gotham Girl in there who flies and has superpowers.
When I say grounded, I don't mean so much. I mean more of this sort of. I'm into sort of like easily understandable sort of stories. As in, I'm into Batman tangling with superpower people. I can get round. It's when he's like battling sort of like monsters and demons, and whenever we sort of have him to do anything like we say with time travel or anything weird like that, I kind of want, you know, you can basically do big superhero stories but still be grounded, basically, you know, so basically no magic or cosmic stuff or anything like that, but basically just like people are like super strong but sort of like, you know, just, you know, wrecking places, that sort of thing I can have with Batman. But it's when it sort of goes into the sort of the realms of fantasy which where I have a problem with it.
Oh, okay, because I'm like, you're gonna get that to a degree with obviously we'd seen Bane who had acquired the Psycho Pirate I don't know how much information you have on the DC lore, but he is sort of, he's got supernatural powers, the way you can control emotions. But you saw that in the latest issue of Batman, so you kind of know what you're
doing. I'm okay with superpowers, but I kind of want him to be more the tangible type as opposed to like the really sort of like, you know, basically a way out sort of cosmic magic type stuff.
Oh, okay, because I'm just like, Psycho Pirate, I think, is a really cool character, all things considered. Yeah. His superpower is he can control people's emotions. I thought that was really cool. That's a character that goes back to even Crisis on Infinite Earths. I know the way Tom King was trying to sell that current issue was, oh, we're going to mention all the stuff that had been happening in Rebirth. Because up until now, it's been all sort of, for the most part, quiet. We've seen a couple of things here and there. I don't know if you know this, Dazza, but they killed off, or quote unquote killed off, Tim Drake. Obviously, it's he was transported as he was about to die. So they're doing a thing where Mr. Oz, who was seen at the end of Rebirth, is actively taking people from the DC universe.
Okay.
And now one of those people was, in fact, Tim Drake. So if you read later on the Batman series and they mention Tim Drake passing away, you know why. Because I remember when me and Alex were reading the big crossover, the one you were talking about, you didn't much care for, the Night of the Monster Men. Mm. They did mention it, and I had to go back and research it because it's like, I didn't know that Tim Drake died. And I'm someone who usually keeps up with comic book news, and I didn't see anybody announce it. But the thing is, they're doing a gimmick where Mr. Oz, obviously that I mentioned earlier, is abducting people. And the way he abducts people, obviously the Tim Drake one was as he was about to die.
And the big one that I've read this week, which is totally different, I got a copy of Doom Patrol issue 1.
Yeah.
Now, okay, for part of the reason I've never read Doom Patrol before. I'm in many ways quite new to sort of reading a lot of the DC stuff. And the reasons why I sort of had a go at this one is because it's written by Gerard Way, who I was a really big fan of My Chemical Romance.
Mm-hmm.
I absolutely really like that band. I'm getting to the age now where there's very few sort of the newest bands or singers today that I really take to because I'm old, and so I basically listen to that much stuff that I basically want. I like stuff that I know, you know, so I'll listen to my compilations and stuff like that. I'm not really into sort of like seeking out, you know, brand new music or anything like that. My Chemical Romance was an exception because I absolutely loved their stuff, you know, and I went to see them once live in concert and I actually had a great time. Really love them. Gerard Way is basically a really big comic guy. You can actually see that in some of the sort of the songs that we used to sing and the showmanship and everything that they do. And he did a really good series called Umbrella Academy, which was like a really weird sci-fi superhero-ish-esque comic, which I really, really enjoyed. So I went into Doom Patrol, didn't really know what to expect. I really, really liked it. I really don't really know what I read because it's just so...
Yeah, that is, in fact, Doom Patrol. Obviously, you could tell from the way he writes, he was a big fan of Grant Morrison's style where it's sort of the surreal. You don't know exactly what's going on. If you read later on issues down the road, it makes a little bit more sense. But just know when you're talking Doom Patrol, specifically Gerard Way, who's a big fan of Grant Morrison and his run, it's very out there.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading, I had no idea what was happening from page to page. I mean, the bit where there's like a universe in the the burrito type thing that she's eating,
that basically
explodes. And then you've got you've got one page where there's a guy just sort of like in a wheelchair playing like an electric organ.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just sort of, it's just like, there's just a page of that and he just stares at it. It's just like, what's that? I took to it because I was a big Monty Python fan growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's got, you know, to me, it's got that little bit of a Monty Python humor where we'll basically just do stuff just for being weird. But it just seemed to, like, you know, work and stuff. And the bit where a character comes in and turns a roommate into a birthday cake and and blows him up. It's like, where's that come from? But I read it and it's sort of like, it came across to me as like really wacky and really way out there. But it didn't come across to me as like pretentious or anything. It just, everything it was doing just seemed to work, and it would just, it sometimes I'll read stuff like that and I'll think, oh, this is kind of just making stuff up and put me off. But this sort of like made me more, there was enough there intrigued that I wanted to find out what was actually going on. That everything, that there was some sort of thought behind this and everything. So I started with that and really enjoyed it, and I will be sticking around with this one, hopefully.
it's very out there. I'm curious to see how long you could stick it out for, Daza.
Yeah, how long does it actually? Because I only just picked the first issue up last week. So, what issue are we on? Because I'm not really up on that.
Issue 2 came out, I think, 2 weeks ago. So you're not too far
right. Behind. Okay, I'll have to order that one, man.
Yeah, it's a good title. It's one of those things to where even I don't know what's going on, and I'm currently reading the Morrison series, so I don't know what's going on, but it's given me enough to where I'm happy where it's going. It's certainly unique. It's something like I've never read before, so I'm reading it, and you know, it's not as good as the Morrison stuff is, but also we're only 2 issues in, so I don't think it'd be fair to compare the two just quite yet.
I've also, I mean, it's not actually out yet, but I placed an order for the first issue of in this DC Young Animal series, which is basically sort of like a young talent, new characters type thing. There's a series called Mother Panic, which for some reason it just caught my eye about sort of like she almost looks like a female Batman. With sort of, you know, but I sort of, it's sort of like, you know, she's a millionaire-ess vigilante. So that caught my eye. I don't think it's out until November, but I sort of, that something about that caught my eye. So I ordered that. So hopefully I'll be able to read that in a few weeks' time and let you know what I think about.
I was a big fan of the recent release of also part of the imprint, Shade the Changing Girl.
Yes, yeah. There's a little bit of a preview of that in there. Yeah, that looked interesting.
I would recommend that. I'm a big fan of that. Also, yeah, you have to take into consideration, it's also very much similar to Doom Patrol. I think it's being written by someone else, but if you had already read Doom Patrol and you like what you're getting there, it's more of that. So, as long as I'm talking all things Young Animal, also. Cave Carson Has an Eye. I think that's the most regular series I've seen so far. That's also by Gerard Way. That seems like a series that has potential, but it's really, the first issue just came out last week, so it's one of those things where I would wait before I recommend something like that, but for sure I'd recommend Shane the Changing Girl.
Right.
All right. Anything else that you've been reading before we start to wrap this up? I know you've been quite busy on halfguard.com writing article after article after article. So, one that caught me completely off guard. I don't know if you had brought it up earlier, but your recent article I think I read this morning was When War Comics Ruled the UK.
Oh, is that up?
That came up, I think, either this morning or yesterday.
Right, okay, because yeah, I posted that a couple of days ago, so I've not been checking, so I didn't know it had come up, but yeah, it's actually I basically polished off the it's one that I actually originally wrote for the Comic Conversations mm-hmm. site, and I basically sort of, you know, took that, just did a bit of a reworking and sort of, you know, polished it up a bit, and sort of because again I think it tied in really well with the 2000 AD tribute that I did a few weeks ago. And I know, you know, there's a chance that a lot of people are onto Half Guard but haven't seen those articles. So, I gave that a polish over. But yeah, it's you know, and for those who don't know, it basically just looks at the a little bit of some of the different comics that, you know, because War Comics in the UK sort of, you know, lasted a lot longer than the ones in America did. And it was like a really big thing for a while. We had what we call Commando Comics, which were like a massive deal. We're still running today from the 60s, one of the longest running comics. And also Battle, which was a really, really, it was almost like a war version of 2000 AD. It actually came out before 2000 AD. Mm-hmm. But it was basically like, very much like full of, mixture of sort of like war stories and anti-hero war stories, like men on the mission stuff. Also had, from my mind, one of the greatest comic strips of all time anyway, which is Charlie's War, which is all about the, it was actually Pat Mills that wrote it, the nice. Great Pat Mills. And he, it was basically about a young lad who his experiences in, as a soldier in the trenches of the First World War. And it's just absolutely incredible comic strip. Just so groundbreaking, and it's basically sort of with a real anti-war stance. It's basically just sort of about what it's like for the many people who were in the trenches and everything, and just an amazing achievement of a comic. I've said this in the article. It's a comic that I really really think should be. It should be required reading. It should be one which is studied for school children.
Nice.
Yeah, because it is sort of, you know, for because in the UK, we there is a lot of, like, what we call young adult books, and like books for, like, 9 to 12, which are to do with the first and Second World War. You know, stuff like, you know, the Biggles books and the machine guns and that. We sort of, like, you know, for children's experience in war. And I think this is one that kids should actually read. Because it shows you the horrors and the senselessness of a conflict like the First World War. It basically deals with, obviously the actual random nature that people were killed, and the sort of, like, people's, how, you know, people just sent to the slaughter on a daily basis, but also, you know, the whole sort of conflicts with the officer classes and stuff like that, and the actual incompetence that led to so many people dying. It's just a really good comic strip, and it is one that I think, you know, should be particularly for, because, like, you know, one of the things I get asked for quite a lot when I'm sort of at work is people sort of wanting books to get kids reading. You know, they say, oh, he's a 9-year-old boy and he's not into reading, what can he read? And then, comic strips are a great way to get kids into reading. And I think Charlie's War is one of those stories that is such an important, well done series that I actually do think it should be studied in schools. You know, because as a learning piece about the First World War and war in general, I don't think it can be beat.
That's good to know. I'll be sure to reread your article. Is it you rewriting, or you're adding to the article that you'd written for us at Comic Conversations?
There's a few things that I sort of, like, changed around a bit. Not to be honest, not massively. There's a few things that I sort of edited about stuff that I've learned since that. So I've sort of, like, you know, corrected a few things here and there. But most of the format and the gist of it is pretty much the same one. I've just sort of, like, you know, tweaked it and stuff like that.
Okay. Unless there's anything else you want to talk about before we wrap this bad boy up, I think that's going to do it for this week's show, Dazza.
No, the only thing I want to say is, was another article that I did a few weeks ago now, which was on the top fights of UFC that never actually happened. And the reason why I just want to mention that is, apart from, you know, check out the article and stuff, it's meant to be a fun article. But one of the things I want to pay tribute to is I put some photographs on there to sort of, you know, and I have to say that Coughlin basically sort of did away with those and chose his own way to illustrate it, and it was a lot better for it.
Oh, okay.
You know, he really, in hindsight, I pretty much did a half-hearted thing on basically just showing pictures of the two people who had said to face each other, and Coughlin basically made it a lot more interesting and a lot more visually, you know, so credit where credit's due. I did the text, but Coughlin worked to basically make the actual article a lot more pleasing to the eye.
There you go. Often, it's not very often that happens. I know sometimes on your article, the images you sent when we were at Comic Conversations, you would go into, you'd specifically go out of your way to get really good images for it. So the idea that Coughlin outdid you, that's refreshing to hear.
Yeah, some of them, I actually think he, there's a few of them where he actually made up the images himself. So he basically took, like, there's a few where he basically took the two fighters and put them into the same photograph in, like, a versus type deal, which I thought was really, you know, creative and sort of, like, so he spent a bit of time for it. So I've got to pay, give a little sort of nod of the head to Coughlin on that one.
Okay.
It was a teamwork here at Half Garder, because we are all about the family and the teamwork.
Very much so.
If one of us does a good article, we've all done a good article.
Pretty much. As long as you're checking out stuff or we're plugging stuff that we've been working on, but I know we recorded it prior, but the way the release schedule is going to work, if you haven't already, check out our top 10 Halloween films as well. That's something that's going to come out pretty soon. I have to imagine this podcast in a couple of days or so, that's going to make its way to halfguard.com. So if you haven't already, check that out as well. We had a lot of fun doing that show. Me and Daz listed off our top 10 horror movies. We had a bit of a crossover, but it was a great learning experience where I learned Daz's taste in horror movies. Daz learned a little bit about my taste in horror movies. So it was a great experience overall. I get the feeling. I'm curious to see what people think of our top 10 and how that compares to other people's.
Yeah, that was a really fun show. You know, right. I think we had a really good time doing that. And we chose some. I mean, I think what surprised me was, I think out of all the choices, I think there was only one where we actually where we crossed over. Mm-hmm. So there's pretty much basically 19 different horror movies that we basically recommend on that show. So you get like a really good cross spectrum of all the different types of horror. So, but yeah, I was really proud of that episode. I think it went really well, and like you said, we had a lot of fun doing it.
Mm-hmm. All right, I think that's gonna do it for this week's show. So from all of us at halfguard.com, thanks for checking out this week's show, and as always, check you guys out next week. Adios.
Bye.